And they know I have a standing desk, so I'm really into it. If you can sit down, I just wanted to get a little energy. We're halfway through, so we're like almost the last day of this thing. Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Thank you for the introduction. Gina, I'm Alex Plum. This research came out of an applied public health practicum I did through my master's program, which I just graduated from in May at Emory University. So I was in Kitui County, which is a rural part of Kenya a few hours east by northeast of Nairobi. And that was last summer, June and July of 2014. So I'm going to share with you the outcome, the research that I conducted as part of that. And I have no financial disclosures to make. So in central Kenya, among the Kamba people, there exists a very unique response to the family-rending tragedy that AIDS has inflicted in Kenya specifically, which has the fourth largest HIV epidemic to date. 1.1 million children have been orphaned by the disease. For the uninitiated, Niambani Village is extraordinary. It's a synthetic village. It was built by the Catholic Church in 2006 to be home to about 1,000 children who are orphaned by the disease. And not only them, but also 100 senior adults who they call their grandparents, umas and shushus. These elder adults were also orphaned when their adult caretaker children died. This was supported by the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and it is a Catholic faith-based organization which receives a lot of support from the institutional from the Catholic institution as an organization, and provides a tremendous support to the kids. There's 100 homes. Kids live, 10 kids to a house with a grandparent that oversees them. They each have a garden. The kids learn and go to school. There's a primary school, a polytechnic academy for kids that don't go to high school. They have a village store where they can get laundry detergent and other materials. There's a church. They have everything. They have just about everything that you would need. The village truly returns much that AIDS stole from its residents. And so when I came in, the question that I was looking at in terms of a social determinant of health is, how does masculinity and identity inform health outcomes? And I think we really have to be holistic when we think about understanding the forces that converge to determine identity and how identity as a social construct influences health outcomes. We know that violence is a public health issue. We talk a lot about that. And as I was preparing to go to Kenya, I started looking in the research about masculinity and social learning and identity. And what I saw was a number of examples where young men's masculinities were threatened. And as a result of that threatening, they enacted violence. One example that made the New York Times in 1991 was an act of violence at St. Cazito Mixed Gender Boarding School, where a gang of 300 boys sexually assaulted and killed 30 young women as a show of force and of their masculinity after a struggle that they'd had with the school administration over something as simple as athletics. And while that's only one small example, and certainly is not indicative of the overall social and cultural forces at work in Kenya or anywhere, it did seem to me to demonstrate at least how resilient masculinity is and how powerful the cultural forces are that can lead young men to act out in destructive and very devastating ways. And so as I prepared to go to Niambani Village, I asked the question, how are boys learning to become men in this very synthetic village, which is absent of traditional pathways, traditional families, and other village structures that would have informed that? And so I asked the question, what are the late adolescence health challenges facing young men in the village? That was the overall structure. And then I asked that vis-a-vis masculine learning theories and Catholic teaching. And that's just kind of a group of the young men who participated in this study. So I did conduct qualitative, in-depth interviews. Qualitative interviews elicit the rich emic perspective behind the numbers. And so I sat and conducted about 30-minute interviews with 29 young men. These are boys who have been residents of Niambani Village for at least 4 years. I obtained their informed consent along with permissions of the village, who the village leader did invite me to come in as a public health student. They have a long-term relationship with Emory University. With the boys, as we recruited, we did some snowball sampling to get more boys to participate, and we did achieve data saturation through the interviews at about 29, right about 27 actually, but I'd already scheduled the other two. I imported the interviews into Max QDA 11 and used a modified grounded theory with inductive and deductive codes to make sense of the data and come up with some findings. So what I want to focus on today really centers around this masculine learning process. And I'm going to share with you, I'm going to blow this up first, and then we'll kind of break it down and we'll put it back together. I want to share the three primary loci of masculine learning, And those three are older boys who are age mates of the respondents, non-relative older men who I call village men, men that work at the Niambani village but aren't relatives of the participants, and then finally the Catholic Church itself. And I'll share what the participants told me are the masculine traits that they learned from each of these sources, and then I'll demonstrate how over time some of these traits have actually shifted. So older boys say, and when I say older boys, I mean not participants themselves, but their age mates, their older friends, boys either in the village or also from their home villages outside of Niambani, they told these young men that that traits related to sexual relationships and earning money were what would identify them as men. So for me to become a man, I must be married. For me to become a man, the participants told me, I must practice sex. They even said I must be a shrewd employee so I don't get taken advantage of by an employer. So these were traits that boys were internalizing that they learned from older boys. In terms of the village men, men who are professionals in Niambani but aren't relatives, they model masculine traits about achieving life goals. And so we heard from Justice, who looked, who considered an uncle from outside Niambani, who said, I want to be like my uncle, who's an accountant. He's not poor, so he can manage his finances. And he has helped some children in our family. And so these village men provide a template role about what achievement can look like. And finally, the Catholic Church, the third, and I should point out here, these are comprehensive. This was the third and only other source of masculine learning that the 29 boys identified. The Catholic Church teaches boys masculine traits that are in line with Christian principles about being loving, about being caring and disciplined. Jim said, and these are all pseudonyms, by the way. Jim said, well, relationships should be meant for the well-being of the other person. And I thought, well, that's a pretty mature thing to think about relationships for a 19-year-old. So those are kind of the three main findings, the three main sources of masculine learning for the boys at Niambani Village. And the framework that I started to kind of put together categorizes these sources of masculine traits that boys learn from living in the village and tries to conceptualize their relationship to one another, because what was very clear in the interviews was how interconnected each of these sources really, really are. And so I'll ask you to pay attention to the size of the circles, the arrows when they come up, and then the intersecting portions of the Venn circles, because that's what's really going to inform, that's certainly what informed my understanding of the masculine learning process. So the first thing you can see is the Catholic Church bubble is a lot bigger than the other two, and that is to represent its significance and its influence on every participant in the study. And that is based on how they communicated, frequency and content of what the boys mentioned when we talked. So they might talk about sexuality being a favorable trait that they learned from older boys, but then they would come and undercut it with a church teaching about what Catholic Church or what the priest or the seminarian had taught them. And it only worked in that direction. We never heard anything about the Catholic Church being a positive trait and then them undercut it with something from the older boys or village men. So the Catholic Church really did have an outsized, important role at informing the traits that boys learned. Okay, I'm going to do that again so you can see it grows. After 6 years, what the arrows are attempting to demonstrate is that over time, for boys who've lived in the village for more than 6 years, the Catholic Church's influence shifts. It helps. It shifts the boys' understanding of masculine learning, of how they learn to become men. I had to go back into the interviews, and because I wasn't really seeing this connection at first, I had to go recategorize all of the traits that boys mentioned, either favorable or non-favorable traits. And then I compared them between boys who'd been in the village for over 6 years and boys who hadn't been in the village yet for 6 years. And for those boys who'd been in the village for over 6 years, they are the ones who were able to say that they were learning new things, and that's what is demonstrated here in the new intersecting portions. There was a shift in understanding in masculine traits. So instead of, for example, here, between what older boys said and what the Catholic Church said, no longer was practicing sex a favorable trait for boys who lived in Niambani Village for more than 6 years. Instead, abstinence was the favorable trait. If I am abstinent, then I will be a healthful man. And that's really, really, really unique. I've not seen that anywhere else in the literature, that you have young men saying, if I'm abstinent, then I'm going to be ready to be a man, or that will help me be a man, a healthy man one day. And similarly for education, when village men are talking about, or maybe not talking about, but modeling achievement, for boys who've lived in the village for more than 6 years, the Catholic Church has shifted that. It's not just achievement for its own sake, but it's it's by being educated first that you're able to be an achieving man one day. And so that masculine learning process really hinges on abstinence and on education, two really very unique and novel traits that I've not seen repeated in the literature that tell us what these boys think it means to become a man. To become a man means to be one who's sexually responsible and one who is educated. And to hear 16, 17, 18-year-olds talk like that is, well, it made the village very excited, but it was very interesting to me as well. So, and then responsibility was at the center of all of those findings. So I think, you know, the weight and importance that boys place on the value of education is really something very important, and it's not a panacea. It's not just good inherently, because what's interesting is that while boys did say that the role of education, you know, helps make the man per se, the village knows how important education is. Young men leave, or sometimes their relatives send them to Niambani Village so that they can go to school. Because school is not necessarily provided in the overall Kenyan context for free for all kids, especially in the rural villages. And so they know how important education is. They know that if they misbehave, they can be sent away from Niambani. And if that happens, for boys who've lived in Niambani Village for more than 6 years, to threaten their education then threatens what it means to become a man. Because if you're not educated, how can you be one who achieves and provides for the family? How can you be one that is ready to get married? And so then education takes on a role that's not only about making you a man or preparing you to be a man, it's now also a deterrent, used by the village as a deterrent, education is, from misbehaving. And on top of the other stresses that boys have, they go to school 6 days a week, these boys are fluent in four languages by 16 or 17 years old. That is outstanding. Studying as much as they do, having to return home after a long day of studying and doing homework and then have to go till the garden or clean their own laundry or cook their own food, you know, it starts to add up. And what we saw from some of the boys was this shame and stress that they started to talk about with respect to sexuality. Because when we asked the question, well, what are the punishments? You know, so you say that education is a deterrent from acting badly. What are you being punished for doing? And they said, if I get caught sleeping with a girl. And so what that turned into was this relationship piece where boys weren't learning how to engage in healthful relationships because they were too afraid to be seen with a girl in case rumors got started and rumors would go up the pipeline and then that might get them kicked out. And so, you know, Hazard talks about having slept with a girl and not knowing if she was safe. Well, that was a unique context because at the end of the day, no one was talking about it. They weren't free to have those conversations with each other for the fear of rumors. They couldn't go to the counselor or the health clinic there for more questions. And so it internalized as a sort of shame. And that obviously is really, really problematic when we start framing sexuality in terms of shame. For something that's, you know, a normal and biological attraction piece, to not have that outlet there, and how education is so tied into it. What's interesting to me, and I kind of put this, the role of the Catholic Church, you know, the Catholic Church is not necessarily monolithic in all of the ways that it's going to influence these things. And I say there's a role of the Catholic Church here because the village was created by the Catholic Church. It's supported by the Catholic Church. The workers and the teachers are all Catholic identifying. 99% of the boys who live there are Catholic identifying. So Catholic leaders have a really important role at sort of teasing out what these pieces are. And with the Catholic Church's current teaching on contraception, for example, I wasn't able in my interview guide to even broach the topic of contraceptives or condoms. Of course, boys mentioned it to me. Boys asked me verbatim, how many times can I use a condom before I can't use it anymore? So there's a severe lack of knowledge and education on this issue that, again, they can't bring up to anyone, because to bring it up, to mention it, again, with education as a deterrent, if you misbehave and you're kicked out of the village, then you lose that education. And that is really what makes the man, and that's what undergirds it all. So problematic. And this all happening in a village, again, these are AIDS orphans, but 10% of them are HIV positive themselves. And so when you've got kids talking about having sex with each other and not having access to contraceptives and not having parents around, right, 10 kids to a house, so it becomes problematic. And so trying to tease that out and seeing the role of masculinity at the center of it all just very, very interesting. And so we presented these findings to the leadership of the village, and they were very interested in it and did say that they had some work cut out for them to work with the boys after this. So as with most qualitative research, the findings really are not generalizable here to other populations. They really do serve a larger purpose of exploring, again, how resilient masculinity is, the ways that that masculine learning can bleed into so many other elements of both social identity, social construction, and then the larger questions of health outcomes and health disparities. I conducted the interviews in English, not Kiswahili, because I don't speak that language, and so only the boys who spoke English could speak to me, and so that is definitely one limitation. But the other piece is, if their English wasn't quite good enough, maybe we couldn't go as deep as we needed to in understanding all the elements of what they were discussing. So we note that. I also want to note here that Kenya is in a post-colonial setting, and so as a white man going into Kenya and working with young people who are all Kenyan, I had to be really careful not to use my presence there as an authority figure to try to exert or exact a certain finding on this. And so it is a limitation just as part of my identity and as the way the study was structured, but I mentioned it to you to let you know that I was being as best I could reflexive about my own identity and the way that I interacted with them. And then the final is just really the taboos around a lot of these things. Not being able to mention contraception, I didn't have a survey or an interview guide item that focused on that, and I'm sure we lost information just because we couldn't really focus on that one sexual health aspect. Sexual and gender minority identity was not mentioned because I worked with a... I was like, oh, wait, I should jump that one. That's okay. I worked with a visiting faculty member from a university, St. Paul's University in Limuru, who was visiting Emory right before I was getting ready to go to Kenya. He himself, Kamba, the same ethnicity and from the same area as the village, and he helped me work through the first iterations of the interview guide. And I had some questions in there about same gender attractionality or gay identifying young men, and he was like, that's got to be excluded. They won't know what that means. You can't bring that up. So for boys who maybe are sexual and gender minorities, we weren't able to go that deep. And then HIV status, boys did not want to disclose. Two boys did disclose HIV status to me, but when I asked a follow-up question, it was very clear that they weren't comfortable going any further than that. So we didn't press that. And so there are other elements of HIV status that could definitely be informing this work too that we couldn't pursue. So really, by way of conclusion, you know, there is a gap in the literature with respect to this idea of education making the man. And that's a really unique finding. It seems to me to be a really healthful finding and a really a good one in many ways. But as we've already seen, it has also been used, maybe not intentionally, as a way that has also caused stress and some amount of shame. And so we just have to, I think, you know, understand a little bit more about the way that boys learn to become men and the way that the Catholic Church, and maybe all churches, and maybe all religious identity, in addition to other cultural forces, can act in substitutive ways when our traditional pathways aren't there. And so that really is the large finding of this. In terms of future directions, a lot of the boys that helped me on this in the very initial part when I got to the village and started to get my feet on the ground and get to know the boys and build up relationships just so that there was a familiarity there, three young men who'd already graduated and were in the village for about 6 more months before they were ready to head to university, they're called leavers because they're leaving the village, they kept asking, you know, when are you going to come back and talk to us? And they knew through participating in this project that what they had been promised, what they'd been taught at Niamani Village might not actually pan out for them when they left Niamani Village and they were on their own in Nairobi or in Kisumu or Lemuru or wherever they went. And so that really, I think, is an important direction that Niamani Village is still responsible for the kids, now hundreds of them who've come through the village, who've graduated and who've moved on. And so thinking about their health in the future and have they learned, have they become the men they thought they would be? And what role did education have? And then finally, because it's always fun to remind the Catholic Church that they have a responsibility with respect to sexuality education, and we hope that one day there'll be some more leadership around that issue, especially for these important populations of vulnerable and marginalized young people. I acknowledge Emory University's Interfaith Health Program, who named me a Joseph W. Blount Scholar and funded the project, particularly John Blevins and Mimi Kaiser, who were instrumental in that project and have maintained good relationships with the Niambani village and organization in Kenya. Sister Mary Owens and Nicholas Ciano lead Niambani Village and provide leadership to the structure, and I thank them for their invitation to come and their support. Peter, Mark, and Martin were the leaders who helped me put this whole study together on the ground, I should say, and were invaluable gatekeepers. Joseph Moutte was the faculty member who helped me put the first iterations of the interview guide together, and Taylor Osborne was my partner in crime when we were on the ground at Niambani Village. Citations for your information. Thank you very much.